And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged. This is a really different edition of Hank Unplugged. This is the very first time I've had a guest on twice. And you can imagine why I would have Raymond Ibrahim on twice if you've heard him once. He's incredibly knowledgeable, articulate. He knows what's going on. He's written some of the most incredible books, including Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. And he's right now in the middle of a project which documents the military history of Islam as only he can do. Now, if you heard him once, you're going to want to hear him twice. And that's why we have Raymond Ibrahim with us again for Hank Unplugged. Raymond, it's great to have you with us.
Great to be with you again, Hank, and thank you for those kind words.
Well, they're from the heart. You know, I really enjoy my conversations with you, but your work has been enormously significant in my own work as I wrote the book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. What I want to talk to you about today, maybe I'll set it up. Islam represents, in my estimation, an enormous threat to Christianity. And it's not only the mass genocide of Christians in the Middle East or the soft persecution of Christians in the West. It is because in concert with global Islamic jihadism, the West is being now, well, it's becoming Islamicized, and that in mind-numbing fashion. Even now, I think it's safe to say that Islam is poised to unseat scientific materialism and Christianity as the Sharia-defining seat of European civilization. And I think it's just a function of plain old demographics. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But this is not new, and that's the point I want to drive at the beginning of this Hank Unplugged podcast segment. Because during the Reformation, Martin Luther saw Islam as the axe of God's judgment falling on an unrepentant Europe and a church that he at least believed represented the Whore of Babylon in Revelation chapter 17. I mean, he had a rather unusual reading of Revelation in general. But I think as well from the perspective of philosophical pagans, all religion was considered to be superstitious nonsense back then. And a majority considered Islam morally superior to Catholicism. And they believed that from both a theological and a sociological perspective. And maybe I should add even from a political perspective. Because even back then, and we're talking about the time of the Reformation, 1517 and beyond, even back then, Christianity was stigmatized as a crusader religion. And it was thought that Islam was the arbiter of reason that had preserved reason during the so-called Dark Ages, and that philosophical wisdom had been advanced not only by Muslim philosophers, but by a Muslim philosophy that was far superior to Christian philosophy. So we're seeing history repeat itself. We're seeing illiberal liberalism, illicit Islam, unseating a common enemy, and that is the Christian ethic in the West. And again, that is all the more reason that I wanted to talk to Raymond Ibrahim and get his perspective on what is going on, because what is going on right now in Western civilization is earth-shaking. This is an epic moment, and this is a moment in either we can capitulate to what's going on or we can educate ourselves and do something while there's yet time. So, Raymond, what's your perspective? I mean, is history really repeating itself?
Absolutely, Hank. You know, you've said so much to comment on, and, you know, almost all of it, actually all of it, right on, and I agree with it. So let's kind of tackle some various aspects that you mentioned. Let's start with the beginning of history. And you are absolutely correct to point out that in Islam, from the start, you know, we see the you know, the physical manifestation, the war, the jihad, the conquests, and so forth, lesser known and forgotten, especially today, but it was well known back then, was that it was first and foremost an attack on Christian doctrine and Christian truths, so much so that among the earliest Christians who came under Islam, such as you know, St. John of Damascus and Al-Kindi and so forth, people living in the 7th and 8th centuries, to them, Islam was just another heresy. It was just one more heresy that had cropped up. And you can see this, of course, in the fact that Muhammad, much of the Quran is so much based on the Bible, Old and New Testament. So to them, they just saw this as a new heresy. And the fundamental attack was on the divinity of Christ, was on his death and resurrection. And like all heresies, you know, it comes in accepting some truths and rejecting others. And so you can see, for instance, that as opposed to other world religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so forth, that have absolutely nothing to say about Christianity, Islam has appropriated Christ and so many other biblical figures, and it says Christ is born of a virgin, he performed miracles, he's coming back on Judgment Day. So you can see all of that worms its way and presents Islam as a sort of you know, co-religion that is in agreement with us, but then it completely attacked the more fundamental aspects, which I alluded to, the divinity of Christ and so forth. And so that was noted from the start amongst the Christian world in the 7th, 8th, and all throughout the centuries. Of course, during the High Ages and Middle Ages and the warfare, to your average Christian, your average crusader, all they understood about Islam is that these are infidels and non-Christians and haters of the cross and so forth. They didn't understand the actual doctrines. And it was always there amongst the more educated clergy and so forth. Now, to your point about, you know, the liberalism and hand-in-hand, that also, hand-in-hand with Islam, that also actually goes back to the beginning, because amongst, you find references in the writings of the church fathers and or the early Christians, not church fathers, of the 7th and 8th centuries and 9th century, and all throughout the Crusader era, pointing out that the one of the major enticements of Islam is that, in as much as it agrees partially with Christianity and so presents itself as a religion and a, you know, monotheism and pious, so too does it actually encourage mankind to you know, fall back on all the vices that Christianity came to put an end to, so such as polygamy or, you know, warfare for plunder or dying and going to a very corporeal and carnal heaven, or having, you know, as many concubines, sex slaves, and so forth. And so they always felt that and saw that because it sort of watered down the conservatism of traditional Christianity, it was also a threat, and that was one of the reasons a lot of, well, not a lot, but a percentage of Christians would often defect and go to Islam, because it allowed them to cultivate, you know, less than Christian ethics and get away with it and be okay with it. You know, for instance, we always hear, it's such a phenomenon, we always hear that in Islam, homosexuality is banned, and in fact, it is. You know, you look at Sharia and Islamic teachings, homosexuality is unequivocally banned. However, if you look at the whole of Islamic history from the beginning to end, you will find nonstop homosexual activity, especially pederasty with boys, constantly going on in the open, boys being bought as sex slaves in markets by Muslims. No one frowns on it. And so there you see that sort of kind of symbiotic. On the one hand, Islam has this fierce, draconian face. On the other hand, so long as you just say the Shahada, proclaim Muhammad is the prophet of Allah and so forth, and toe the line, as it were, you can basically get away with all sorts of depravities and so forth. All of that was noted from the very start of Islam up until quite recently. Of course, now we're seeing the shift, which I think we can, you know, progress to whenever you want, of how liberals are presenting Islam as this, you know, wonderful teaching and doctrine, and the reason, of course, is because they have something in common with Islam, and this is why, you know, I look at it and I see, why is it the big question, you know, why do liberals of all stripes, you know, feminists, multiculturalists, homosexuals, anyone, they all side with Islam against the oppressive Christian patriarchy and so forth, when in fact Islam is slaughtering their kind. Women are chattel. Homosexuals, as I said, technically are killed if they're infidels, at least. And I think the reason is, it really goes back to a very simple sentence, which is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And the enemy, the greater enemy of the liberal world, has always been Christianity. And therefore, its friend is the enemy of Christianity, the traditional ancient enemy of Christianity, which is Islam. And we've seen this not just historically, but it's, as you were pointing out, cropping its head out again, once again, right now.
This is an interesting thing that you bring up, because the mantra we hear in the West again and again is that religion of Islam is a religion of peace and tolerance. That mantra is being communicated over and over again. Conversely, we hear that Christianity is a crusader religion. I suppose in some way, I'm interested in what you think sociologically. I mean, do you think that people actually believe this, the people that are saying this, or is it more along the lines that you mentioned, that the enemy of my enemy is my enemy?
I think it's a little bit of both, and it depends on who you're talking about. So it's, I think, you see, what's happened today with history is, you know, whereas once people, educated, rational people, used to look to history and look to the facts as documented and then formulate a conclusion. What's going on today is we have an a priori conclusion or conclusions, most of which are based on wishful thinking. And that comes first. And then based on that, we go into history, or we don't go into history at all. And then we understand it according to that that context. And so I'll give you an example in the field of Middle Eastern and Islamic studies. I'm sure you're aware of Edward Said and his book, Orientalism.
I am.
Right. And as you probably know, this very much is touted as revolutionizing the study of the Middle East and the Islamic world and so forth. And the reason for that is much less than anything innate to the book, which is really, as so many people have already shown and pointed out, it's a book written by a literary professor with a very little, a coherency or a serious historical argument. But what made it successful, as so many things are made successful today, is less that what it said and more that it came at a time where it was needed. Okay, so in the 60s and the 70s, the idea came out, okay, multiculturalism, no real truths, all this going hand in hand, of course, with that, you know, the boogeyman of all world history is the white medieval Christian man. All of these things sort of coalesced, as you know, in the 60s and 70s and so forth. And so when a book like Orientalism came out, which basically said everything we ever known or heard or learned from the so-called Orientalists, which are the pioneers, the European scholars who studied the East, the Orient, is just nonsense. It's all lies. It was all fabricated to, and here you see, you know, popular psychology also, you know, made famous in the 60s and 70s and so forth, come into play, all to, justify oppressing the other and so forth. And so what it did is, it based on all the prominent philosophies that were in the air, you know, whether it's Marxist, materialist Marxism, you know, which says that all history is basically a product of economics. It has nothing to do with ideology. And so if one group attacks another group, it's because that group, you know, has material wants. And so it wants to get what the other group has. There's nothing ideological about it. You know, you had that thought floating in the air. You have, of course, multiculturalism. And so in that context, one question that everyone had to figure out is, well, what do you do with 13 centuries of European Christian writings that unequivocally demonize everything about Islam, from its theology to its history? And so the funny thing is, what Orientalism said and what people jumped on and accepted is, it said, you just dismiss it, you throw it away. Why? Because we know that by virtue of our philosophy, as I was saying, the idea comes first, and our idea is all people act the same, regardless. And therefore, we can honestly say that Muslims cannot have acted any worse than Christians. That's just an idea we've accepted. And we've already said that if there's violence, it's because of material needs and all these other ideas. And so what do you do with the fact that there's 13 centuries of Christians demonizing Muslims? Well, obviously, that's 13 centuries of evil Christians, hypocrites, and envious Christians who are intentionally demonizing Muslims so they can justify going and colonizing them and taking over them. And that idea just went rampant. Everyone loved it. It's still prominent right now, not because he proved anything, but because, like I said, it fit the need. It fitted what people wanted to understand. And yet, but if you look at those writings that I'm alluding to, the 13 centuries of Christian writings, if you knew those writings and you understood them, everything that's happening right now, ISIS and so forth, makes absolute perfect sense, because ISIS becomes just another piece of the continuity that started in the 7th century with Muhammad. And the reason we are now today all asking what happened, what's wrong, why do they hate us, is because we've jettisoned that history and decided instead to, you know, create this fiction. So in short, to your point, I think there's both concepts at work. I think there's those who are consciously trying to enable and empower any kind of force that dilutes and waters down Christianity, whether it be Islam, liberalism, or anything. And then I think there's the masses who have been so conditioned into believing these, you know, these overarching principles of culturalism, relativism, moral relativism, materialism, all of which conclude that there's no way you can say Muslims have done anything worse than Christians. And I don't care how many history books have, or chronicles, including Muslim ones, say that. We will jettison that idea and move forward. So I think that's what's at play fundamentally.
You mentioned the Islamic State, and maybe you can give a little update on where you think the Islamic State or ISIL is at this particular point in time. What's the condition of their Islamic movement? But even beyond that, I want to get to what you think the real issue is. Is the real issue the terrorist attacks, or is the riptide that you don't see the real issue, and that is the demographic issue, a nation or an area or a civilization that becomes Islamic demographically will succumb to Islam politically as well?
Well, absolutely. See, what the media does, and the powers that be, and the creators and guardians and enforcers of what I call the narrative, with a capital N, you know, what they do is they have certain tactics and strategies. So on the one hand, and it's interesting to me because they use the same kind both to explain history and modern events. And really it revolves around omission and distortion. So in history, we see that they omit, you know, the entirety of Islamic violence, which is just 13 centuries of Islamic jihad continuity. That's omitted. Then they take something out of context, because you don't have that context now, and they distort it. And from here we understand all of the demonization revolving around the Crusades. It boggles my mind when I read people, you know, Karen Armstrong, John Esposito, and so many others, they're just the famous ones, who portray the Crusades as this sort of, in a vacuum, it just happened. You know, sometime around 1095, this one Pope Urban, you know, he decided, you know, we had a good thing going with the Muslim world, and they just started demonizing Islam, demonizing Muhammad, because they just wanted to go and conquer and colonize, you know, Jerusalem. And people buy into that. If you look at the history, of course, there was 400 or 500 years of relentless jihad. You know, the 10 years right before or 15 years before the Crusades, they were almost at Constantinople, and that's how this all started. The emperor contacted the Pope for help. They had literally destroyed in Armenia thousands of churches, the Turks who were the champion bearers of Islam and so forth. And so, you know, going back to the point of omission and distortion. So on the one hand, we get nothing about what Islam has been doing. Then on the other hand, we are told, well, look at what the Crusaders did. And then that becomes its own standalone thing. So moving to the modern era, you see the same sort of thing at work. When Islamic terrorists do their spectacular attacks, you know, the media has no choice but to report on it. And more so when the Islamic terrorists themselves are already propagating it and disseminating it on the internet the way the Islamic State does. You know, make no mistake about it that the media would not be covering all the violence and atrocities the Islamic State was doing had it not been that the latter is the one who actually propagates it, and then the media obviously has to go along. It can't not comment about it. But if you went back before the Islamic State, who has a tendency, it likes to disseminate its atrocities, there were so many other Islamic groups in the modern era, in the 90s and 80s and so forth, that engaged in the same activities, but they didn't disseminate it, they didn't boast about it, and sure enough, the media never talked about it. So on the one hand, they talk about the spectacular attacks because they have to, but it also helps them because the underlying assumption is that this is really the big problem, these terrorist attacks. Now, this is what we have to talk about. And of course, it's distant from Islam. It has nothing to do with Islam. These are criminals. These are terrorists, et cetera, et cetera. But all the while, the much bigger narrative, just like, the 13 centuries of nonstop Muslim jihad in Europe, for example, the much bigger modern narrative is that all around the Islamic world, you're seeing the same imperial tendency, the same attacks. So on the one hand, of course, as you mentioned earlier, what's happening to Christian minorities all around the Islamic world, in Africa, Asia, even in parts of Europe and so forth, you're seeing them being literally persecuted into extinction. But now you're also seeing what you're alluding to, what's happening in Europe and in the West, with these migrants, and you're seeing these enclaves basically in Europe where they're like little Sharia-run emirates right in the heart of Europe where police are scared. You're seeing all the same stuff that has been happening in the Islamic world to Christians and still continues to happen is now happening in Europe. And that makes absolute sense because where Muslims grow in numbers, then obviously the same phenomena intrinsic to the Muslim world is going to grow with them. And if you want to look at this mathematically, even if you want to say, well, only 10% of Muslims are terrorists. Okay, so if you only have 100 Muslims, that only means you only have 10 terrorists in your country. But if you have 10,000 Muslims in your country, that means you have 1,000 terrorists. And so obviously it grows in proportion. But so that's the story that the media doesn't want to talk about. The Christian persecution thing, look at that alone. Consistently every year, Open Doors, the human rights group, publishes an annual report about Christian persecution, and they list the absolute 50 worst nations. 40 of them consistently are Muslim nations. The top 10 absolute worst, where if you're a Christian, where I think they said, if you're a Christian, you are 100% persecuted in some way, 9 of them are Islamic. And the ones that are doing this are not terrorists. They're not ISIS. They're not, criminals who have hijacked Islam. They are the heads of state governments, including our good friends and allies, Saudi Arabia, the government, which is intent on destroying any single church they find, which raids homes, private residences of foreign Christians who are quietly praying and throws them in jail. And so forth. It's the mob, and you see this in Egypt, you see this in Pakistan, attacking churches, killing so-called blasphemers. And so you have what ISIS is doing really is happening all around the world, often at a much lesser level because mobs are not professionals. They don't know. They can get up and burn, throw a Molotov cocktail and maybe burn part of a church, but they don't go and, detonate it and kill 50 or 60 people. But it's the same hostility is going on everywhere in the Middle East. It's going on in Europe. It's here in America. And that is, like you're saying, really the big story that just like the other big story of history, which is 13 unwavering centuries of hostility, is the one that no one is talking about. And instead, what they do is they distract and they throw a red herring, which is Islamic terrorism, which, yes, is bad. And I'm not trying to downplay it, but it's just one more manifestation, a more spectacular manifestation of a much bigger, deep-seated problem.
Back in the Reformation period, there are many like Luther who believed that the Roman Catholics were a far worse menace than was Islam. And as I alluded to earlier, they saw Islam as the axe of God's judgment falling against a Catholic Europe. And we sort of have that same thing going on today. The idea that somehow or other, Christianity is the worst of all religions because it is a crusader religion. And I know that you touched on this the last time we spoke, but I think it deserves to be underscored, this idea that this is pure mythology. Mythology on the level of the myth of the Andalusian paradise.
Yeah, Hank, this it's important, really, and a lot of people I know are uncomfortable with this. I think both you and I, present company, not included. You really have to understand what's happening in the context of Protestantism, because As history unequivocally records, with Martin Luther, as you said, you know, the sort of relativism that we see today, you know, whereby Muslims can go and bomb and burn and rape and enslave, and, you know, we relativize that by saying, yeah, but what about the Inquisition or the Crusades? That goes all the way back to the Protestant Reformation and to Martin Luther and others like John Calvin. These guys, who, by the way, you know, from the Catholic point of view, and I'm not a Catholic, but just to give you the historical concept, just like the Catholic early church saw the Muslims as a heresy, of course, from the Catholic point of view, the Protestants were a heresy, you know, yet another one that didn't get stomped out, and that's how it was seen. And so what Martin Luther did is, as you said, he justified them. This is the rightful judgment of God, but it was much worse than that. He actually encouraged people not to resist them. There's actually a sentence, I can give you the quote later, attributed to him saying that, well, this one is famous, that he said basically that the Pope, like you said, is the Antichrist. Now, the word Antichrist was often in Europe attributed to the Sultan, the Ottoman Sultan at the time, who literally, under his authority, had hundreds of thousands of Christians either enslaved or slaughtered in the context of the jihad. Okay, so when Martin Luther and John Calvin and these fellows came and said that the Pope, for all his faults, and I'm not defending the Pope, like I said, I'm not Catholic, and from what I understand, the Catholic Church certainly had its faults, but for all his faults, for them to basically put him on a level with the Sultan and even say he's, and they said he's worse, was really the beginning of this sort of relativism we see. Because to say that this one man, the Pope, who doesn't go and butcher and burn and Christians and enslave them and burn and destroy churches is as bad as the Muslim fellow who does, you can see immediately the sort of relativistic thinking that still plagues us to this day. But Martin Luther, actually, the sentence I was talking about, he says, after all, he's worse, the Pope, than the Sultan, because whereas the Sultan kills human bodies, meaning Christians, after all, what is so bad about that? Because they go to heaven, don't they, the Christians? Whereas the Pope is killing their soul. And so, you know, whatever the theological argument may be, again, look at what this man is really setting up. He's basically saying the persecution of real people physically and killing them is not as bad as, you know, what the Pope was doing. And then, you know, you get all this propaganda from the Protestants that completely put out of context what Catholic Europe was doing. The Inquisition, if you really study it today, was actually considered an act of mercy. Because I read this, two of the authors, you can check them out, Madden, I think it's John Madden of the Crusades, Thomas Madden, and Rodney Stark. You know, they've done some good work, and they basically conclude the Inquisition was actually, in its context, in its history, an act of mercy, because without it, people would have been killed and burned as enemies of the state, because to be a non-Christian or Catholic, you are an enemy of your state immediately. The Inquisition actually ended up killing something like 3% of the people they tried, but it saved 97% and so forth. So anyway, that's not the point. My point is the Protestants, the early Protestants, really created a lot of propaganda. You know, Vlad Tepes, Dracula, and all the artwork they drew in Germany and just totally demonized them, even though in his country he's a hero because he actually kept the Muslims out in the wars against the Ottomans and so forth. So this kind of thing carried over into the Enlightenment, you know, and the Enlightenment was mostly in Protestant nations, you know, France excluded. And you get, again, that same, Catholicism bad, Crusaders bad, it's the crusading religion, like you say, it's all about violence and indulgences and et cetera, et cetera. And really, that's the roots of how we get where we are, because that became the sort of Western epistemology of medieval Christianity. Bad. It's bad, it's evil, it's corrupt, it's hypocritical. Therefore, what do? You find the counterbalance. And who was the counterbalance? Who's the foil to medieval Christianity? Well, it's Islam. And in fact, in practice, this happened. The Protestants, you know, there's several instances where Protestants and Muslims worked together against the Catholics, and you see this, for instance, right before the siege of Vienna in 1683, and that's the Holy Roman Empire of Vienna, which is Catholic, of course. The Muslims and the Protestants in Hungary worked together, you find the same thing earlier during Sultan Suleiman's era. And, you know, the British or the English sometimes helped and worked with Muslims in Spain against the Catholic monarchy and so forth. So all of that, the Protestant Reformation, you know, say what you will about its significance and theology, which I'm not getting into, historically has really laid the groundwork for this massive split and the reason that the Western, quote-unquote, world, or Western epistemology, rather, has such a dislike for historic Christianity. And the correlation of that is a like for Muslims, because then you prop them up like Edward Gibbon did in his history, and so many others, and Voltaire and all these guys. They become your foil. So to show how bad Christians were, well, you show how their opponents, historic opponents, Muslims, were so wonderful. And this is now the origins or in the myth making of the Andalusian myth. And all this sort of thing. And of course, this goes hand in hand with what I was saying, which is you jettison 13 centuries of well-documented history. You create all these fantasies. You create this new history in order to support your idea, which is, you know, based on all these theories and so forth.
That's interesting to me. As I hear you speak, I constantly try to think about the sociology of all of this. I mean, is this motivated blindness? Is this the inability to perceive inconvenient data? Is this the kind of shoddy research that was spoken about in the book, The Myth of the Andalusian Paradise, where you have bad research in the bastions or the ivory towers of the intellectuals that is now passed on through journalists? Is it selling a cultural agenda? I mean, what's the sociology behind all of this?
It's all of the, everything you've said, the part to do this. I'll give you an example. You know, here's relatively, you know, here's what a modern historian will do who doesn't really have an agenda. Maybe he's not a liberal. He doesn't have an axe to grind. But here's what happened. Because, and I know this from my own field, a historian, especially if you get a graduate degree, you've had a PhD or so forth, you always have to come up with something new. Okay, you know, what's your new thesis? Yeah, it's already been said, but we have to come up with something new. So what people end up coming up with is something that is new that fits the zeitgeist, all right, the cultural spirit, if I'm pronouncing it that right.
That's right.
That prevails in our society. And so in our the spirit that prevails in our society is the multicultural one. It's the one that sort of wants to keep medieval Christian white man down, wants to elevate everyone else and show how wonderful they were. And so people naturally are going to go to the sources. And so what happens now, they go and all of a sudden they make any argument they want that fits that. And immediately it's a wonderful thesis and it gets spread around and so forth. And so I'll give you an idea. The Battle of Tours or Poitiers, in which every historian from that moment in the 8th century, you know, the Chronicle 754 and so forth, up until people like Gibbon, who of course had that hostility for Catholicism, made clear was very decisive and pivotal and in keeping Islam out of continental Europe, or at least keeping it confined to Spain. This has been an unquestioned fact. Now, the new theses that are touted and everyone says them is, no, this was just a little skirmish. It had nothing to do with anything. The Muslims weren't even there to conquer. They just were there for plunder and booty and so forth, all of which is demonstrably false. And I actually talk about this in my book. But the reason that it becomes popular is because it fits what people want to hear. They don't want to hear about some epic warfare and how Christendom was saved from hostile Islam. They want to hear the opposite. So it becomes minimized. So that's just one example of how even unsuspecting scholars and academics fall into propagating this sort of narrative. But all the aspects that you mentioned are at play. You know, it's sheer ignorance. It's just a machine that's self-feeding and self-perpetuating, this thing. You know, it goes back the historical roots, like I talked about, with Protestantism and then the Enlightenment and, you know, the Romantic movement. And then in the 20th century, you get all these isms, materialism, relativism, culturalism, multiculturalism, all of which have one consistent theme. And basically it is to denigrate and therefore justify a break from historic traditional European Christianity as it was practiced. I mean, that's when you talk about, everyone talks about, you know, conservatives versus liberals. Well, what does that mean? I mean, that to me has always been code for conservative is someone who wants to maintain, you know, Christian culture and ethics, and a liberal is someone who wants to break away from them and say, no, let's forget about all that stuff. Let's have fun. Let's break free from it. I mean, that's what it's always been. And it is in that context that this issue of Islam comes in. It's yet another tool that can be used to, you know, promote the thesis that historic traditional Christianity is bad and everyone else is good. And it does it by the way we talked. It just completely distorts history. It omits history. It fabricates. And then it perpetuates itself because people are indoctrinated in believing this. The thought comes before the facts. And so it's in their head already. And then anyone who says anything is believed. You know, Karen Armstrong, John Esposito, the statements that I've seen them say are just not only false, but they are the literal antithesis to reality. Okay, but those are best-selling authors and, you know, widely heralded and touted and so forth because they say what we want to hear. And so that's where we're at.
I think it's absolutely stunning to hear former President Barack Obama, who should know better, to say that Islam ought to be able to practice religion as it sees fit in the West, knowing that Islam allows a man to beat a woman to bring her into submission. It just seems so counterintuitive with respect to everything else he supposedly stands for. But it's not just him. I mean, you think of Carly Fiorina talking about the myth of the Andalusian paradise. I mean, she personified it. I mean, if it wasn't for Islam, we'd be still living in the Dark Ages. It was Islam that brought mathematics and philosophy and the culture of the Greeks through the Christian Dark Ages into the present light. You can go through these intellectual they're cultural elites, but they're very intellectual people as well. I mean, Barack Obama grew up in a Muslim context. He knows all this stuff. He's a historian. And yet, given the fact that he seems to be for women's rights, he's willing to go back and say that this barbaric religion ought to be practiced as modern Muslims see fit in Western democracies. It didn't make any sense.
Well, you know, it makes sense to me in a very kind of weird way that, you know, you may or may not agree with. And it kind of goes, I think I've alluded to this, it's basically the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I really believe that the grand enemy that is behind this sort of thinking, the grand enemy for this sort of thinking is historic, traditional, cultural, Christian ethics. Which have built Western civilization. So this is why someone like Obama and your average feminist white woman in America will say what you just said about how wonderful Islam is, even though they can see with their own eyes the opposite of their own claims and read with their own eyes in the Quran and the Hadith and so forth, the opposite of their own claims, and yet lambast, you know, Christian patriarchy constantly, which doesn't do anything like that, and in fact is behind the so-called liberation of women. Because fundamentally, I really don't think any of these people are give a fig about human rights or about female rights or about anything. I think they are ultimately motivated by a desire to demonize and thereby justify breaking away from historic Christianity. You know, you ever think to yourself, when you think of civilizations around the world, it's only the West is distinct for having such an abhorrent hatred for its own past. No one else has this break in continuity. Muslims, of course, as we know, praise and glorify their history, but so do Hindus, so do the Chinese and the Japanese. Everyone does. What is behind the fact that the one civilization that actually had a meteoric rise in the world and that abolished slavery and that did all and create, you know, brought all these baboons, you know, technology and democracy and freedom. And now it is so hated by its own people and demonized as being the absolute worst civilization ever. Now, to me, you can't explain that rationally. There's something else behind it. There's a darker force behind this sort of thinking because it is so singular, it is so irrational, it is so topsy-turvy. And like I said, I believe it begins and it ends with You look at what we call liberals, multiculturalists, secularists, feminists, atheists, homosexuals, whatever you want to call them. They all, Muslims, of course, who aren't even part of that, they all have the same common disdain for Christian cultural ethics and mores deep down inside, whether they say it or not. And that is the, I believe that is the driving force for what they do and what they say. It's not because they care about, you know, other people. It's not because of their humanitarian inclinations or their need to see women liberated or so forth. No, that's always the pretext that's being used for the other reason.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. I mean, what I'd like to do is sort of look at the big picture with you for a few moments. I mean, right now we look at North Korea. We'll look at what's going on with respect to the protests to our flag. As you point out, America has always been self-correcting, and yet there are so many people, I think, oftentimes ill-informed, that consider America evil, that consider the flag a symbol of hate, bigotry, and everything that's wrong with the world. Then you have the sexual revolution, of transgenderism and gender fluidity, same-sex sexuality, and the list goes on. On top of that, you have what we've been talking about specifically, illicit Islam, not only terrorism, but the demographic problem where we're self-aborting and polygamous Muslims are rushing in to fill the vacuum. You look at that toxic mixture. What do you make of what is going to happen to Western civilization with the obvious understanding you're not a prophet and one person with God can create a revolution in another direction, in the direction of changing this culture for the good? But you look at the toxic mix right now and it's mind-numbing.
Yeah, it's, you know, depending on which country, I mean, but when you say West, I agree. I mean, there's definitely a continuity. It just affects each part a little different. Some places are a little more progressive, but pun is intended, and they're progressively suffering faster, such as Western Europe, Germany. I believe what's going to happen is if the status quo, if the mentality that I, if this dominant mainstream way of looking at the world, which is basically, you know, European Christian heritage, everything is said and done, evil, everyone else, good, okay, this overarching domineering worldview, which is so indoctrinated now in people's minds, Western people, of course, exclusively, if that continues, then the natural outcome, of course, is just self-extinction and suicide. And that's what you're seeing in some of these countries. It's just amazing to see in Germany or in Sweden, you know, Muslims brought in by the droves, then they go on raping sprees and have sex rings where they, you know, molest and abuse and groom thousands of, European girls and so forth. And then the police don't do anything because they're afraid of being politically incorrect or called a racist. The government doesn't do anything except bring in more. They actually tell women in Scandinavia and Germany to dye their hair, to dye their blonde hair dark so they don't stand out and warrant the attention of migrants and so forth. So that mentality, of course, is destined to extinction. And I hasten to add, I don't mind to see that, because if any elements in the Western or other world that can't stand up for itself in the most basic sense in defending its own self, its own turf, its own women and children, well, it doesn't really have much to stand for anymore. It's pretty much defunct and pointless. And it will go the way of the dodo. And I personally won't lament it because there was nothing there. Of course, I'd like to see a change. I'd like to see people wake up, open their eyes, and act on reality. But I think that's harder said than done because, you know, a lot of us in this field, we keep thinking that it's all about making rational argumentation and documentation and, you know, showing, for example, on the topic of Islam, showing people what the Quran says, showing people what Islamic history has said and done and so forth. Well, that works with rational people, okay? But I think the plague right now that's infecting much of the West is such that it's irrational. It doesn't matter what facts you show and talk about and present. Again, the idea precedes the facts, and that's all that matters. We've been, or people have been so indoctrinated on these isms, multiculturalism, materialism, relativism, the idea that the beginning and end of all historic evils or the white Christian medieval man. All these ideas have become so ingrained that unless you can get them out of people's minds and make them think rationally, then there's nothing that can be done. Like I said, we can't just keep arguing it and show evidence. We've showed all the evidence you need. What more? I mean, I used to think when I was younger that, well, you know, when I wrote the Al-Qaeda Reader, for instance, it was published in 2007. I worked on it in 2005. I thought, look, this is great. Here's some Arabic documents by Al-Qaeda saying, proving their true intention, which is just jihad and subjugation and so forth, not grievances. And I honestly thought, oh, great, I am going to translate and publish this, and, you know, hopefully it'll open people's eyes. Well, it did to some people, but most people it didn't. And it's not because they didn't say that or it's not documented. It's just we are dealing now with a sort of irrationality that just transcends argumentation. It doesn't care about facts. And until something happens to that kind of thinking and people become a little more rational and look at evidence and look at facts and, you know, stop living in clouds, even as they see their people and their lands being taken over and butchered, there won't really be any change.
You know what's interesting about this? I'm just thinking as you're talking about the fact that you don't have to wonder what civilization would look like under Islam because of what happened in Andalusia, in medieval Spain. But even more to that point, I mean, you look at your book, Crucified Again. Here we have what's, by any standard, mass genocide taking place against Christians in the Middle East. I mean, so it's not as though we have to think back to a period from, 711 to 1492 or something like that to figure out what the world would look like under Islam. We can look at what it would look like in the West by simply turning our eyes to the East.
Well, it's even more than that. I mean, you're absolutely right. But look simply to the West, where you have large numbers of Muslims, and look and see what's happening there. You know, these enclaves in Australia and Germany and Scandinavia and Britain, they're basically like little third world regions. We don't even have to go as far as the Middle East, even though I agree with you. I mean, the one thing I've always liked about Islam is its unwavering continuity. Okay, from day one of its history, until today, it is not changed. You know, it follows certain themes. There has never been a time when a Muslim state or power did not attack a non-Muslim state, except when it was weaker. I mean, that is historically demonstrable. Anytime a Muslim state was stronger, it went on the offensive. It was in the name of jihad and Allah. They had to, and so forth. So today, of course, you don't see the Muslim world invading Europe and attacking it because it can. Rather, you see the opposite. You see its allies, its ideological allies, who have the same enemy, bringing them in to Europe to continue what was happening before. You know, I look at, you know, you see in Europe, for instance, you can see all the things that happen, and people will, the apologists will tell you, well, that's just crime, or, oh, they're just desperate, they don't have enough money, they're economically impoverished, that's why they're committing crimes, et cetera, et cetera. But what do you do with the fact that wherever there's large Muslim populations in Europe now, you constantly see churches being attacked, desecrated, crosses being broken? I mean, how do you explain that? That's just hate. They gain nothing by it. They could get in trouble if they get caught. They're not robbing. They're not raping. It's a manifestation of hate. And it's happened so many times in Europe, constantly. Muslims go on rampages, destroying, in one instance in Germany, I think over one night, 50 churches were attacked and crosses broken and statues and so forth. Now, Muslims used to do that in Europe, but they did that coming in on horses and camels during warfare and jihads in Spain and in the Balkans and the Ottomans and so forth. Now, they can't do it, but you have an element that's bringing them in. And that's, of course, the much more dangerous element. As I always say, Islam in and of itself today is intrinsically weak. It's not a threat. The reason it's a threat, the reason Western people are being killed by it and oppressed by it, is because of Western people who actually whitewash it, praise it, turn the other blind eye, both here and there, as in the case of Rotherham in England, where they were the sex ring and police knew about it. They didn't want to do anything about it because they'd be racist. And then bring them in through migration and so forth. And so you see the same thing going on. And that's why really the bigger problem is what we've kind of been talking about more, which isn't the Muslim mentality and what Muslims are doing, which, you know, I give the analogy, you know, if I imagine zookeepers one day start saying, you know what, let's stop demonizing lions and saying that they just like to kill zebras. You know, they're doing that because they're hungry. We keep them well fed. They're going to get along. And then they start insisting that zebras and lions are in the same cage or in the same little field, and they feed the lions a lot. And sure enough, the lions get lazy. They don't attack zebras. But then once in a while, they go and attack and kill zebras and tear them to pieces just because that's what lions do. Now, who's at fault, the lion or the zookeeper? I think the latter, obviously. The lion does what the lion does, and the Muslim jihadi does what the Muslim jihadi does. But who is enabling them? Who's empowering them? Who's turning a blind eye? And that really is where the problem starts and ends.
I think you've already said it pretty eloquently, but I think it bears repeating. I want you to reemphasize what you've just said about the fact that Islam is not that strong worldwide militarily. In other words, the military might of the West far exceeds Islamic military power. And therefore, what we are doing is we are self-destructing from within. In other words, we're opening the floodgates for a lesser power to come in and destroy.
Exactly. Look, historically, and you know, you mentioned my book, and that's exactly what it is. Historically, the West, or even Christendom, could not resist. Literally two-thirds of the original Christian territory or Christendom was seized permanently by Islam in the jihad. It wasn't because Europeans or Westerners or Christians gave it to them. They fought tooth and nail, and they got beat because there were just hordes and hordes that kept coming, different manifestations, Arabs, Turks, Tartars, and so forth, always attacking Europe from every side, from the Mediterranean, from Spain, and from the East and the Balkans, and so forth. And they would get very far. You know, they got, like we said, tours deep in the heart of France. Italy was continuously raided. Rome was sacked, I think, twice in the 9th century, 200 years before the Crusades, by the way. The Vatican was attacked, and that's why there's walls around the Vatican, and yet we have an inhabitant, Pope Francis, who's constantly telling people to drop their walls, and he misses the irony of his own residence. But it was a constant onslaught, and you know, Christians fought to the death, and then they eventually won. And now Islam is a spent force. I mean, it's what can Muslims? I mean, if there was if the West had the mentality of the Muslim world, it'd be over. Or vice versa, if the Islamic world had the military might of the West, there'd be no West. The West would be part of Dar al-Islam by now, a long time ago. It wouldn't even be a question. And so, yes, this is the crux of the matter. Islam has been doing what Islam has been doing. But the big difference today is that whereas it did it because it could, because it was strong, and you had a rational power combating it, Christian Europe, now you have your prodigal son of Christian Europe, the secular West, going out of its way to empower Islam so that it may continue what it started when it was strong. And again, and the inescapable fact of all this is that, you know, it's Islam is really fundamentally not the issue here, because Islam could easily be neutralized. I mean, the simplest thing is I'm just, you know, ban immigration from Muslim countries. As simple as that. And there it goes, at least in the Western world. So what you're seeing, all the terrorism and all this, it is 100% enabled by Western elements.
Let's talk about this from a financial standpoint. I've oftentimes said that if Christians did what many cults and world religions did for a lie, if Christians would do that for the truth, we'd be able to turn the world upside down, very much like the first century Christians did. Today you have Saudi money building madrasas and mosques all over the world, including in Western parts of the world. So you have hundreds of millions of dollars being spent on propagating Islam. And on the other side of the coin, you had a lot of this money is coming out of Saudi Arabia, as I mentioned, but then you had the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia declaring it necessary to destroy every church in the whole of the Arabian Peninsula, and Western governments do not so much as blink. So you got two things going on. One is they are exporting a virulent brand of, well, authentic Islam all around the world. And on the other hand, when they're destroying Christianity within their own cultures, they're still our best friends. We don't say anything.
Well, you know, the Saudi example is especially pertinent because, as you know, Saudi Arabia is home of so-called Wahhabi Islam. And, of course, all these terms, Wahhabi, Salafist, and so forth, really are smokescreens. You know, Wahhabi, Salafism, same thing. All that means is literal Islam, following the example of Muhammad as in the Sunnah. You know, the Islamic State and Wahhabi Saudi Arabia are, when it's all said and done, Sunnis. That's all they define themselves as. So anyway, all of these little distractive words aside, Saudi Arabia, of course, practices the ISIS brand of Islam, literal Islam, and what they call Wahhabism or Hanbalism. Like I said, there's all kinds of names that just distract. This is the country that is we are best friends with, like you said about the fatwa. Do you know that in Saudi Arabia, keep this in mind, the government and the ulama or the Islamic clerics are the same. Okay, so the government is actually the religious authority. And so according to the religious authority, the ulama, the fatwas, anything that comes out is actually sanctioned by the government. And they had, I actually translated it some time back, it was online for the world to see, but only in Arabic, a fatwa based on the doctrine of loyalty and enmity or blah, blah, blah. And it's basically saying every Muslim is obligated to hate and despise and, when possible, subvert and conquer non-Muslims. Okay, and now this is the government of Saudi Arabia saying that, and yet our presidents hug them, kiss them, bow to them, and dance with swords with them. Okay, and so from here you can start getting an idea of the depth of the problem and what it really is. It's not about a specific strong brand of Islam. It's something a lot more homegrown here that is enabling it.
There are some movements, and they seem very rational and erudite. I see them on Fox News, or at least representatives of it on Fox News, as well as other news programs. But they're talking in this very intellectual way about the need for reformation within Islam. But it seems to me that reformation within Islam is simply a way of saying, go back to the roots of Islam. Go back to what Muhammad was originally proliferating in terms of violence, in terms of the way women are treated, in terms of his global jihadist enterprise. So reformation of Islam seems to be exactly the wrong thing. And it sounds wonderful because we think about reformation being a good thing. But reformation in Islam is basically saying, we'll take moderate Islam, if there is such a thing, and go back and make it radical.
Yeah, well, you see, they get away with that. And the reason they do that, and the reason it's popular, is because, as you said, you know, the word reformation connotes, you know, positive change on the one hand. The other hand, the deeper reason is, again, going back to these isms that plague Western thinking, relativism. The relativistic way of thinking is such that, well, if Christianity, which must have been so bad in its historic manifestation, was able to reform, quote-unquote, improve, then surely violent Islam can also reform and improve. But if you look at what the Reformation was essentially saying, okay, we're done with a clerical hierarchy. We're done with any extra biblical authority, sola scripture. All we care about is the word of God, and we are going to read that and follow that. Okay, very good. When you do that, because the word of God is full of good things, humanitarian things, brotherly love, peace, and so forth, justice, well, when people do that, it's good. Now, if you want a reformation in Islam, and the same thing on the same concepts, because that's what happened, well, that's called ISIS. That's what you're seeing right now. Because historically, Islam had what, you know, historians call a medieval synthesis, and this really affected its own self more than it did the other. But because Islam is so stringent and you know, full of draconian laws, Muslims, once they couldn't expand and enjoy the boons of jihad anymore, were left with Islam, and they kind of like mellowed it out for their own sake so they can get along. And they did all these kind of, like I said, it's a synthesis of the teachings, and they came up with new interpretations, again, just for society. Even then, the infidel is infidel. You have to warn him, kill him, et cetera. Okay, now what the so-called Salafis and the Wahhabis and these people who've existed from day one These aren't a modern aberration. You know, Ibn Hanbal is one of the founders of the four madhabs or schools of Islamic law in the 9th century, and he is basically the forefather of ISIS and all these guys. He takes the Quran literally and follows it, and as well as the statements in the hadith of Muhammad. So what you're seeing now is a lot of Muslims are saying, well, we're done with this so-called synthesis. We don't care what this the ulama or the scholars of Islam have said or done. All we care about is what is the Quran, the words of God or Allah say, and what does Muhammad, his sunnah, his example, as captured in the hadith say. Now, when you do that, when you distill Islam to those two sources, you get ISIS. Because, in fact, what the Quran says literally and what Muhammad especially did is just pure barbaric violence and enslavement, rape, destruction of churches, everything you see, killing blasphemers, killing the apostate, conquering the entire world, going to a carnal heaven and so forth. If you kill yourself, fighting for Allah. So if you want a reformation in Islam, well, you got it. And it's basically what you're seeing today. But you see, going back to the relativistic way of thinking, people have this presupposition that, especially secular people, that you know all religions preach the same thing. So by reformation, we just mean we want them to calm down and kind of be cool. Well, that's not the case with what Protestantism was. Protestantism just kind of, you know, got rid of the clerical authority and just went to scripture. Well, if Muslims do that, you get ISIS. And so it doesn't work. But you have to first acknowledge that the Bible and Islamic scriptures are actually very much antithetical to one another in their teachings. And people who are, of course, the relativistic way of thinking can't acknowledge that. They're not going to say one's better than the other. Or if they do, they'll say, you know, Islam's better. But they can never come and make that distinction and say, oh, well, yes. You know, like multiculturalism. Think about it. The idea that all cultures are equal. No, they're not. Some cultures are better. I mean, what is a culture? A culture, when it's all said and done, is a philosophy. It's a way of life. It's a standard of what is right and wrong. Certainly, in that context, there are better cultures. You know, which culture do you want? The one that when the man dies, they burn his wife? Or the one that doesn't? And, of course, the former is, you know, Hindu culture, for example. So all that, this is why, you know, people are just so paralyzed by this kind of relativistic thinking, that they can't connect the dots, they can't see things for what they are, and therefore they can't act on it.
You touched on this a little earlier in our conversation, but perhaps a little more elaboration would be helpful. What do you think the state of ISIS is today, and do you think that it's likely that it's going to birth a far more dangerous ideological child?
You know, when I'm asked about that, I have to be honest with you, I've never really paid too much attention to what I call the temporal manifestations of jihad, which are, you know, this or that organization. You know, yes, I do, and I know what they're about, and I read them, and you know. But what I don't like is when I see people get caught in this idea of our problem, our enemy is ISIS. Mm-hmm. We need to defeat them. Well, it used to be our problem and enemy was Al-Qaeda. That doesn't even, we don't even talk about it anymore. Now it's this. You know, a long time ago, I might have told you this, but I wrote an article, you know, based on the myth of Hercules and his warfare with the Hydra monster, whereby, you know, each time he cuts a head off, two new heads sprout out. And so it's, if we keep thinking our problem is this or that terrorist organization and we just focus on it, not that I think we're doing that, because the Islamic State has been around for several years now and, you know, supposedly the strongest power in the world, America, plus all its allies can't beat it. So I don't even think we're trying to. But if we keep pinpointing all of our problems onto one finite temporal organization, we completely miss the point. You can destroy ISIS tomorrow. You still have, you know, back to the, you know, the analogy of Hercules, the only way he could kill that monster, you know, he cuts his head to pop out, he had to cauterize with fire the stump. And then no heads came out. So by analogy, you got to cauterize the ideology that gives birth to all these heads. You attack it and you neutralize it and you kill it. You know, when was it? Remember when everyone was singing and dancing, Osama bin Laden is dead. I remember like CNN. We can now basically say the war on terror is over. Really. As if it all, you know, it's all embodied in one man. And so, you know, to think that all of it is embodied in the Islamic State, all that is embodied in Boko Haram or in Hamas or Hezbollah or, you know, Al-Shabaab, I mean, we can go on and on, is to miss the point. No, it's embodied in a body of teachings that are considered divine and sacred, and that instead of, as our forefathers once did, combating it or showing how it's false, we, the West, are going out of our way to just pay lip service to and empower. So really, the problem is far beyond something like ISIS. But not that I don't want to see it beaten, you know, neutralized. I'm just saying I don't want people to get caught up on thinking that really is the issue when it's not. It's just one of so many potential heads.
Yeah, so you got a couple of things going on here. On the one hand, we've talked about the demographic problem. And that problem's not going away anytime soon. I see that like the rip current. You can't necessarily see it, but it's moving along progressively. And, you know, as I said, nations that become Islamic demographically are going to become Islamic politically as well. But what you're thinking, I mean, I'm asking you to be a bit of a prophet here, look into the future. So I'm doing that advisedly, obviously. You don't know the future, neither do I. But what do you see based on current trends with respect to terrorist attacks? Do you think that they're going to continue to escalate in terms of numbers, closeness and proximity and so forth?
Yeah, you know, a long time ago, I formulated what I call Islam's rule of number. Okay, you know, let's go back to the Islamic world, where Islam is strong and where you have large numbers of Muslims, and you see how non-Muslims are being treated. Of course, Christians tend to be a non-Muslim minority. And as we've seen, there's an unmitigated war of terrorism and persecution against them. Okay, and that's what's happening because and that's when Muslims are strong, when they have the government, when Christians are already ostracized, have no voice, have no power, they're still being attacked. Okay, now you take that paradigm and you apply it elsewhere. So, you know, where are we? I was reading, for instance, remember the Nice terror attack in France. I forget how many died, the truck, 70 or so people. And then Reuters came up with an article. And the whole article from beginning to end is showing why Muslims are angry at France. And it goes all the way back, of course, to the Crusades, because, you know, the Franks were the original Crusaders. And it goes back to this, and it goes back to that. But then it has some French authority, the president or someone, saying that France is the number one European terror country being terrorized. But then somewhere else in that article, it also says France has the largest Muslim population. And to me, you know, there's the correlation. It's not because of the Crusades. It's not about grievances. It's because they have a very large Muslim minority, something like, I don't know, is it 10%? I don't know, of the whole country or just Paris or something like that, which is definitely significant for a Western nation. Therefore, I am not surprised to see that France is also the number one country being threatened and terrorized by Muslim terrorists. Because, again, going back to the, you know, keeping this very mathematical, you can say, oh, the radicals are a very small percentage. Well, fine, 1%. Okay, but 1% of 100 is only one potential guy in a whole nation. 1% of, you know, 100,000, you're going to have a much higher obvious percentage for acts of terrorism. So that's what I see. The more Muslim numbers grow in Western nations, you will see all the same phenomena, the anti-infidel hostility, including terrorist attacks, that you see happening to Christians in the Muslim world. You're going to see that happening in those countries. And of course, we're seeing that right now. But the more the numbers grow, the more you will see it. So that's basically my forecast.
Yeah, I'm looking at a tweet by Hillary Clinton. You got to see this. She says, "It's about time, ladies, start your engines!" Exclamation point. Then there's a picture of the Saudi flag, you know, blue skies behind it. And this is Saudi Arabia to let women drive at last. So it sounds like Hillary Clinton is tweeting about an epic forward movement with respect to women in Saudi Arabia that we all should applaud, probably forgetting the bigger issue with respect to women in Islam.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that kind of thing is just so endless. And again, it goes back to the point of just show you the hypocrisy. You know, someone like Hillary Clinton is supposed to be a big spokeswoman for women's rights and equality. And here she is in bed, and I don't know how many millions she got from Saudi Arabia, who her ally, who of course treats women like chattel. And all that just tells me, you know what, these people don't give a fig about all the things they claim to, all their little, you know, moral outrage about treatment of women, treatment of homosexuals, treatment of this, treatment of that. That is always a pretext, moral outrage used to try to shame, you know, other people who do care and actually have a conscience and unfortunately fall for it. And that's what all that is, you know, like Obama, the same thing you were saying, and how he, you know, supposedly is a feminist and supports it, and yet his alliance and with Islamic nations, empowering the Muslim Brotherhood, this is all not unintentional. It's intentional, basically. And, you know, people need to see it for what it is, and they're not going to see it as long as they're just paralyzed by the predominant philosophy that just kind of permeates everything in the West, so that facts and evidence are just invisible to us.
What would the difference been if Hillary Clinton would have been elected as president of the United States in terms of the opening of our borders?
Well, I mean, opening the borders, you're going to get a lot of undesirable elements. If you just want to keep this on track with Islam, you know, keep in mind there's a lot of Islamic terror cells in Mexico, operating very close to the Texas border, especially, that have been found and documented. So opening that, just again, focusing on the Islamic part, not just the overall migrant problem, you're bringing in more terrorists. That's the bottom line. These people who are dead set about migration from the Islamic world are basically the ones who are killing their own population. I mean, it's just facts and it's numbers. First of all, what has always driven me crazy is supposedly this migrant crisis was precipitated by ISIS, and everyone's scared and running away. Well, for some reason, the people we're taking in tend to be 99.5% Sunni Muslims, which is basically the same sect that ISIS belongs to. ISIS doesn't enslave Sunni women, doesn't bomb Sunni mosques. It does it to Shias. It does it, of course, to Christian churches and Druze and Yazidis and so forth. And yet the ones that are supposedly fleeing, who are you know, these poor fugitives who end up throwing Christians out of their boats because they're praying, or who in refugee camps kill and attack Christians, you know, it just gives you an idea of, you know, these so-called refugees, the kind of mentality, the supremacist mentality they have. We know this. This is it. 99% are Sunnis. And we know ISIS has said it's planting its own people among it, to say nothing of the fact that, you know, there's many of them that just share the same worldview, because it's based ultimately on Islamic Jihad. And so to know all this, and then say, I'm still going to bring them in, then you are the one who is killing your own citizens. Someone like Merkel is another prime example. And what's happening to Germany, and, you know, mass rapes and attacks and destruction of churches and killing. I was reading about a woman who was, you know, killed and raped, and they stabbed her with her own cross and burned a Bible. It was Muslim migrants. Those Western leaders are 100% behind this. You know, to go back to, like I told you, the analogy of the lion and the zebra and things like this. Or it's like, if you want to think of it as if there's a beverage and I say, you know, only 1% of it is poisoned, so let's drink it anyway. Well, you know, you're still, by telling me to drink it, poisoning me. But we do know that those elements are mixed within the population. I think it's much larger than they say. Because, like I said, the people who are coming in are Sunni Muslims. When you have people who claim to be refugees, who need help, who need sympathy, who need, you know, our humanitarian help, and yet you see that within their own closed circle, refugee camps all over Europe, they're killing and attacking and raping those who are not like them, meaning Christians, well, then you just basically took in a bunch of ISIS as refugees. and they're going to end up doing to you what they're doing there, and we've already seen that. And so it's really a mess. And when you really think about it, like I do, and we have discussed right now, it just shows you how bad the problem is. This isn't about correcting a wrong, providing facts, making people see reality, and then they'll change it. No, this is a lot more deep-seated. It's a lot more subtle. It's like a plague that paralyzes people. They can't think right. They can't act right. They can't implement the correct policy. And it's just kind of eating away. It's actually diabolical in its nature, when you really look at it. That's how antithetical it is to proper judgment and prudent action. It is 100% the reverse. It's not just a little worse. It's not just a little off in this way. And that's why I say, to me, this whole issue about Islamic terrorism and so forth, we can't separate it from this larger issue of what's going on in the West, in the Western epistemology and mentality. It's a 100% byproduct of it. And so, you know, it's pointless to even talk about it because it's intrinsically weak as well. Really, the problem is this other issue that's homegrown. And, you know, a lot of people who are in my field to talk about radical Islam and so forth, you know, more power to them, but they don't get that part. And without getting that part, you're really, it's again, it's the Hercules analogy. You're just cutting a head off and pop up. It won't matter. You got to get to the actual root of the problem. And the root of the problem is much more closer to home.
When you talk about closer to home, give us a little perspective of what's going on in Dearborn, Michigan.
Well, I mean, Dearborn, Michigan is another place that you have a very large Muslim population. And so what do you see there? Well, you see what happens in Muslim countries. I was reading the other day, I didn't know about this. I think it was in 2010 where they arrested it was Dearborn or somewhere in that area, like a Somali sex ring led by Somalis. And they raped like 20 or 30 young American girls. And it was kind of hush-hush. And nothing really talked about the religious aspect, even though, of course, you go back to that statistic, the 50 worst nations that persecute Christians and therefore are very pious and zealous about their Islam. The number one worst nation today is Somalia. And you see this, if you're just exposed as a Christian, they kill you right away. No questions asked. So when I see Somalis in America or elsewhere doing this sort of thing, this isn't just because, well, they're foreign or come from a weird third world nation. No, it's because they have that Islamic mentality in them to prey on the infidel, on the other, and so forth. So in places like Dearborn, Michigan, you have a large Muslim population. So get ready to see the sorts of things that are happening wherever you have large numbers of Muslims living next to infidel, which is what we're seeing today, including that and other things.
Here's a final perspective I want to get from you, and that is, what about the people? And this may be Pollyannish, but a lot of people are saying, look, this is an unprecedented opportunity to have Muslim immigration, because now, instead of having to go to the mission field, we have a mission field on our own doorstep. They're here. We can reach them with the gospel. So this is a great, great opportunity for mission work vis-a-vis Muslims.
I actually think that's an okay argument, a fine argument, in as much as it depends on how much the person who's making it is presenting Christian truths unequivocally and not kowtowing to Islam. Because all too often, the ecumenicalists who claim to want to bring the gospel to Islam seem to do nothing more than re-fortify Muslim sense in Islam by praising it, by telling them, oh, look how wonderful it is. It cites Jesus and this and that. You know, there might be something to it in that it's a gradual way of bringing them to Christianity and so forth. But short of it being a virile, aggressive, assertive, but with love and compassion, confrontation against Islamic truths, it's not going to do much, in my opinion. And my understanding of Western Christianity is it doesn't do that sort of thing anymore. I'm not, of course, speaking about everyone, but in general, it takes a much more reserved, cautious, walking on eggshells type thing. And from what I know about Muslims, Muslims are actually, I'll give it to them, they'll appreciate a more straightforward, hard-hitting argument than all the, pussyfooting around and walking on eggshells. To them, that's perceived as weakness and just proof that your position is false. So, it could work, but you'd have to actually have a robust Christian message juxtaposed to it.
Yeah, maybe you can expand on that just a little bit, because I think you're putting your finger on something that is very crucial. And I can say anecdotally that what you're saying is absolutely true. You need a robust form of Christianity. You can't have the health and wealth gospel version of Christianity or some politicized version of Christianity or Christianity that's been demythologized, as in the liberal branches of the churches. You have to have robust Christianity. And this is the anecdote, I led a Muslim to the Lord, and he lived in our home for over a year. To dispossess him of Muslim underpinnings was more than a conversion process. It was a discipleship process that took a long period of time. I mean, I remember 6 or 7 months into the process, there were still harbingers of Islam in his mind that needed to be eradicated.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying. And, to build on top of that, I'll give you an example. You may have heard of him. He's popular in the Arabic world, but I wrote about him in Zachariah Butra. He's a Coptic priest and he has his own satellite TV, so I haven't seen him in a while, but I think he still does. And some years back, he and others, so he's a Coptic Christian priest, others are Muslims who converted to Christianity, so they have these satellite programs in Arabic. And what they do is they preach the gospel, and they just show you everywhere how Islam is wrong, you know, unapologetically. They bring out all the dirt about Islam from the Quran, from the Hadith, and they just throw it in their face in the Muslims and say, is this really what you believe? Here's what Muhammad said. Here's what Muhammad did. Here's your book. It's quoted in this Hadith. It's quoted in that Sahih or canonical Hadith. But they don't leave it just there, you see, and that's the thing that a lot of secular people don't understand. Secularism is not appealing enough to your average Muslim. You need to fight fire with fire. You can't just hope to make a Muslim break away from his beliefs so he can become secularist. In fact, it's the opposite. That's why you're seeing a lot of secular, jaded Western people converting to Islam. So if you're going to combat Islam and try to strip the theology away, you have to fight fire with fire in that you have to provide a new theology. A new vision of God. And that's what these people do. They don't placate. They don't appease. They don't walk an eggshell. They preach it as it is. They get, Muslims get angry. Muslims call in, threaten to kill them. And then other Muslims call in, say, I wanted to kill you a year ago. I've been watching you. Now I've come to Christ and so forth. So it's a much deeper battle. And that's why I'm saying, I think it has merits, but you have to have that robust Christianity first to fight it. Like you said, the truths of Islam are so etched into the Muslim psyche that you're not just going to get it, gone overnight. Because a lot of these things become embedded as cultural aspects. It's not even so much theology anymore. It just becomes a cultural trait. And that's why you see a lot of Muslims are hostile. They have a tribal mentality. They're hostile to everyone else because Islam is tribal. It's us, the Muslim world, Dara al-Islam, versus the non-Muslim tribes of the world, the infidels. And so even if a Muslim doesn't read the Quran or doesn't even really believe it, when they grow in those societies, they take on these cultural traits, including tribalism, the idea that, me and mine, we work against you, we take advantage of you, we rob, steal, plunder, kill you. And it doesn't have to have a religious, jihad. They'll just do it. And this is actually in the Islamic world. What happens is Christians and minorities get targeted by criminal elements who do it because they know no one's going to say anything to them. It's not because they're religious, but they know that the religious types won't, hold them to blame if they rape a Christian woman as opposed to raping a Muslim woman. It can be done, but you need to, you actually need to get real believers to make the argument forcefully.
Kind of a final topic here. As you know, I wrote a book titled Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. I'm going to be doing interviews with respect to that book. Some advice from a pro that's been plowing this field for a while. What am I going to face and how am I going to face it?
Well, first, let me just say I received a copy of your book, which I liked very much. I've only perused in it. I've put all reading on hold until I'm done with my own book in a couple of weeks. But I look forward to reading it in its entirety. But from what I've seen, I like the acronym. I think the acronym is spot on. With what you say with each letter of the word Muslim. But what you can expect, again, is, it depends on who's interviewing you. But, I've learned that, make the rational argument, make the documented argument, but don't hold your breath in thinking that that's going to change too many people. It will change some people. There's a lot of people on the fence who still have some semblance of rationality, but there's a lot more who it just doesn't matter. Like I said, it's the a priori idea comes before the facts, okay? So if what you say, it doesn't matter how much is documented, because we already know history is made up, history is written by the victors, scriptures can mean or say anything you want them to say. I mean, this is the dominant mentality we're dealing with. But also expect that, you're going against the grain. You're one of those people who is attacking Muslims. You're an Islamophobe. So you might expect some of that, too. And with all the cheap shots that they'll take, you're a racist, you're attacking Muslims. Of course, Islam has nothing to do with race. There's blonde-haired, blue-eyed Muslim converts, so it has nothing to do with race, and that's why everyone who makes that argument fundamentally is just showing you how bankrupt their apologetics are, that they have to rely on such a cheap shot, but it works, and that's why they do it. because a lot of people are more terrified of being accused of racist than actually standing their ground. But I wish you the best of luck, and I think you will do well, because I believe your argument is cogent. Like I said, I've learned that no matter how ironclad an argument can be, we are in a day and age where it's not about how strong an argument is. It's just how much what you say accords with what people want to believe.
Yeah, one more thing, and that is your book, Crucified Again. Just a quick summary on how important it is for us as Christians in the West to be praying for our brothers and sisters that are facing mass genocide in the East.
It's very important to pray, to know, and you know, even possibly to help. I mean, what a missed opportunity when we had this whole migrant crisis. And what does Obama do? He goes out of his way to make sure that the people who come in are Sunni Muslims, because, as he said, that's not who we are. We don't go by religion. Well, the fact is, Christians not only assimilate in America and Western nations in general due to the shared religious heritage and truths, but they're the ones who are actually being persecuted. They're the ones who are being killed by ISIS. It's not fellow Sunni Muslims. So, you know, that aside, but the true, you know, the Crucified Again in the book and the truths of it are today just as bad as they've ever been. I mean, it's literally a genocide in some parts. And, you know, learn from it and learn what's happening, because, like I said, the remarkable thing about Islam is its consistency through continents and centuries, especially in the context of whenever their numbers grow. And the behavior of Muslims vis-a-vis neighboring non-Muslims. I mean, it's all there. You can see it in Crucified Again. You can see it in history. And you're seeing it right now. So that's why no one can really claim ignorance. It's the same story being repeated over and over. And it's just time for people to open their eyes.
Well, this particular edition of Hank Unplugged with Raymond Ibrahim, just fantastic. He's a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's an associate fellow at the Middle East Forum. He's appeared on MSNBC. Sorry about that. He's appeared on Fox News, Al Jazeera. He's testified before Congress on the plight of persecuted Christians. All of his works, anything he does, you'll find at equip.org, both what he's done in the past and what he'll do in the present and going forward. So he's someone that you want to read. He's someone that you want to be familiar with. And I'm deeply grateful to your insights, Raymond. I think they're critical for people to listen to hear, to absorb, and then ultimately to act on. I mean, we can curse the darkness or we can build a lighthouse in the midst of the gathering storm. I want to remind everyone listening in to go to iTunes and leave a review and then share what you've been listening to with other people as well. Again, Raymond, I'm deeply grateful to you for spending so much time with us.
It's my pleasure, Hank. Anytime. I appreciate it. And thank you for all the kind words. And anytime, I'm always happy to talk to you.
Look forward to talking to you again in the near future. And Godspeed on your work. And pray for Raymond. I mean, he's put himself on the line. I mean, as you've heard in this podcast, he does not mince words. He's not trying to be politically correct. He's trying to give all of us a wake-up call. Look forward to seeing you next time on another edition of Hank Unplugged.